Hi. Let's check the quality of sound, the quality of video, because some people complain time to time that the sound is not high enough, is not strong enough. So please check whether you can hear me well. If something goes wrong, let me know. I will try to fix the settings here. But I believe we are at the maximum right now. So as usual, you ask me questions and I try to answer them with as much honesty and sincerity as possible. You can ask me any questions, but like I said on the previous stream, I am mostly interested in questions about management in software teams, and also less interested, but it seems that you guys are very interested in that, the career questions, how to become a senior developer, how to stop being a junior developer, or how to be more effective junior developer. These kind of questions are also welcome, even though I do not consider myself a career expert. I'm more on the management side, where I do consider myself some sort of an expert. Let's start with the first question. When it is possible to expect my third book, the third volume of Elegant Objects? I actually planned to publish it 2 years ago. And the idea of this book, the idea of the volume two, is to present object-oriented programming in a way that, in my understanding, is better than what Java can give us, or C++, or any other object-oriented programming language, which, in my understanding, are not object-oriented languages, but are hybrid languages. They have certain elements of object orientation, but at the same time, they do have a large inheritance of procedural programming, of imperative programming. We deal with hybrid languages, and this is what is a problem. This is what causes bad design decisions and the software with low maintainability, which we call legacy code or spaghetti code. In volume 3, I expect to present you design patterns or scenarios of programming, scenarios of problem solving, basically the problems which typically programmers face in their life, the tasks, the problems. And I will demonstrate how these problems can be solved with the use of a better language. And this better language is EOLang, the language which we are working on right now, which unfortunately is not ready yet. We are improving it, we are making changes, we are changing the semantic of the language, we are doing a lot of work, actually, as we speak right now, today, yesterday, on this week, we made changes to this language. That's why I cannot proceed with the book. I actually wrote the first few sections in the book, where I'm planning to write maybe 40 sections or something like that. So I wrote two of them, but the code in these sections, the code is written in this EOL language, and I cannot compile these code snippets because the language is not 100% ready. So I'm waiting for the language. As soon as the language is fully ready, which is going to happen very soon, I hope maybe in months, maybe 2 months, then I continue actively finishing the book, and I really hope that this year is going to be published. I hope I answered your question. Next question, do I have tips for getting master and doctor degree? Well, actually, I don't have either. I don't have a master degree. I don't have a doctor degree. I do have the degree which was given to people in the Soviet Union, which is not called master. That was a different story. We were studying for 5 years, and I got this degree, which is probably similar to what is called now master. And I don't have the doctor degree. I actually was studying for the PhD for 2 years, but then I quit. So I'm not a doctor, and I have no idea how to get that degree, even though I'm thinking about it. So I believe the best tip I can get is you just follow the process which your university will present you, will ask you to follow. Each university has its own process. You just apply, you listen to what this the academic stuff is telling you, and just go to the lectures, get the pass the exams, and you will be fine. This is the idea of academic education, I believe, the formal education, is that if you graduate, if you get the degree, this is basically an indicator that you managed to pass all the necessary steps of this education. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're smart. It doesn't mean that you are better than somebody else. It doesn't mean that you can solve problems which some people cannot solve. In my opinion, it doesn't mean any of that. What it means is that you are capable of reading the documentation, writing the papers according to the requirements, listening to the lectures, understanding and structuring certain material in your head, capable of presenting this material to the teacher when the teacher asks you the questions, capable of making presentations in front of students. You basically can play by the rules. And when you graduate from the school, you can play by a small amount of rules. When you graduate the university, you can play by a larger amount of rules, more strict rules, more difficult to obey. And which is important for some jobs, which is important for some employers, which is important for somebody. That's what academic education is about, as I understand it. Next question. You're saying the sound is cool. That's good. Next question. Tell us more about politics in tech. Do you remember the case when Google Android bullied smartphone manufacturers when they tried to ship Yandex Kit devices to Russia? Well, I think we shouldn't talk about politics and tech. We should talk about just politics and tech. I think the entire world right now is about tech. And many people write about that, many books about that, that the world now is controlled by large tech corporations. These corporations are larger than governments. They control way more resources than any particular government, well, aside maybe from the top 10 countries. But if you take an average-sized country, then this country will be smaller than Apple by the amount of resources they control, smaller than Microsoft, smaller than Google. So these tech giants, they not only control the resources, they also control the data, which is now is way more important than anything else. So, of course, there is politics there. Of course, they try to enforce certain agenda on us, on people. And they do it, I believe, because, of course, first of all, they want to make profit. And when they have such a large amount of people inside their audience, they are subscribers, they are their users, they are their followers. Of course, they want to use this audience for their own private purpose. So every one of you, every one of us, every one of, including myself, we are the resource for them. And it would be weird, it would be strange if they wouldn't do that, if they wouldn't use us the same way as politicians use us. The politicians, they rely on our opinion. They rely that we're going to support them. If we support them, they get access to larger amount of resources. So they're going to live without actually doing anything. They're going to live on the money which we give them. So tech is doing the same. I don't think I'm saying anything original here. I think it's just obvious and it's just happening. This is what we have. Thanks to internet, mostly. Thanks to semiconductors, thanks to the last 50 years of development of the advanced technologies, specifically computing technologies. Do we like that? Maybe you're going to ask me that. Do I like that the tech corporations are in charge of the world? I think I think it's better than having somebody who we don't see in charge. somebody will inevitably be in charge. And it's obvious that it's not going to, it's, those are not the governments. The governments are not powerful enough in this world now, well, due to many reasons. Well, not only internet, but internet as well, but also the transport. Now we can transport, now we can move from country to country way faster. So now the borders between countries, they are more artificial than real. They're not anymore, they don't mean that much as they meant 200 years ago. So that's why there will be somebody on a higher level than the governments of these individual countries. And if we see who they are, if we know that this is the Google Corporation, of course we don't know who is standing behind that name. We don't know who is the actual owner of the Google Corporation. But at least we know that there is a corporation. At least they are obliged to publish certain documents. And at least they have to explain what they do. Well, in the court, of course, it's more like a show for us. But still, at least they do something. At least we know their name. It's Google. Because before that, we didn't even know that. There was like somebody controls us. Who they are, have no idea. So I vote for the power of tech corporations, which is better than the fake power of the governments. Next question. What do you think about freelancing? Is this an alternative to the standard sitting in a big company? Is it important for you whether a person has a well-promoted freelance profile or not? I am in general in favor of freelancing a lot. I do believe that freelancing is the right way to organize resources and to get the most effective output from people, from programmers, from projects, from everything. But at the same time, I do see that these large corporations, they are not big fans of freelancing. They are not even big fans of remote work. They expect us to be in the office. They expect us to work full time. They expect to be on a payroll. They don't want to pay for our results. They want to pay for our time. They want to owe us. So they want to be our owners. That's what they're trying to do. And that's, again, that's reasonable. If you would be them, you would do the same. You wouldn't like those freelancers who can go anywhere just tomorrow. If they don't like your project, they just walk away. If they don't like what Google does, they just shut their computers and go somewhere else. Google's not going to like that. So that's why Google saying, no, we all of you have to be my employees. That's the way we're going to organize our work. Forget freelancing. If you are a freelancer, you're sort of a rebel. So you're like a protester. You're against the current. You swim against the current. And your life will be, I think, more and more difficult. Comparing to the life of people who go to the office, who sit in the office, who are protected by these large corporations, who are the slaves actually being owned. They belong to somebody. They belong to the system, and the system protects them. When you are a freelancer, the system doesn't like you and doesn't protect you. So it's really a personal decision right now. Even though I would love to live in the world where these freelancers will be everywhere and there will be no large corporations and everything will be managed by by the community and there would be so-called balanced democracy where the decisions are made by smart people and by the elite group of smart people who are visible, who are known, who are elected, who are not even elected, but who are certified to be the leaders of the community. That would be the utopian world, which I don't think we will ever get there, but we should dream about it. Next question. What do you do in case you have hired a developer, but you see that the developer doesn't have enough hard skills? By hard skills, you mean he doesn't know how to write code, or she. What do I do in this case? I usually try to classify developers into two categories, sometimes overlapping. The first category is the people who don't want to work. They don't want to work. They just don't have the motivation. The second category is the people who don't know how to work. They just don't have the skills. So the person who is not satisfying your requirements is either in the first category, he doesn't want, he doesn't know what for, he just doesn't like the project. Or in the second category, he doesn't know how to solve the tasks. He just doesn't know Java good enough to solve the the problems you ask that guy to solve. Sometimes these categories overlap. Sometimes you deal with people who don't want and cannot. This is the category where you fire, where you terminate the person, where you try to do everything to just get rid of the guy because he doesn't want and he doesn't know how. That's just not for you. But if the person is in the first category or the second category, you try to help. Well, that's what I, that's the philosophy I preach. You try to help. If the person doesn't want, but you understand that the skills are over there, then you try to build the motivational plan. Try to explain why this project is important. Try to show the bonus. Try to give more money or promise more money. If the person is in the second category, then you just train that guy because he wants, he has the desire to work. He just doesn't know how. So just help him or her to learn. I believe that you're asking this question because you deal with the person who is in both categories at the same time. Then just get rid of the guy. That's it. He will find a job somewhere else. He will find a job where a different set of technologies will be required. And at the same time, the salary will be bigger. So the motivation will be fixed and the skills match will also be fixed. Next question. Are you planning to do a PhD dissertation yourself? Yeah, I am working on that. I hope that I will, in the nearest future, I will defend it and I'll get the degree. That's my objective for the nearest future. Next one, question. How you became high-level manager? What will be if you had not have your principles in programming and management? I don't think I'm a high-level manager. Oh, you're asking how to become a high-level manager. and, you know, my principles in programming and my principles in management, they are actually causing troubles to me. They're not helping me at all. I would be definitely way more successful and way more, way higher level manager if I would not have that principles of management. Like my principles of management are very rigid and very strict, as you may know if you read my blog. I believe that, for starters, some people must be punished for the lack of result. And this is not what the modern management in software development actually appreciates. And I also believe that the performance of programmers must be evaluated, must be measured with metrics. And this is also something which most programmers these days do not appreciate. And you know, read the comments on the YouTube channel on the previous talks. When I say that that programmers must be paid less because they don't produce enough results, people start unsubscribing from me. I actually got a response, a very funny response from somebody a few weeks ago. The guy was saying that I'm listening to you. Yegor, he's addressing this to me. I'm listening to you and I turn into your hater because you keep saying that programmers are not productive and they have to get less money. And then eventually I'm planning to unsubscribe. So this guy, and probably he's a very, very good representative of a large community, this guy expects me to say, you deserve more. You deserve more money. You are a good programmer, no matter what is your performance, because it's because not only performance matters. You as a human being is a valuable asset of a company, so we have to give you more. Then he will subscribe. He will enjoy it. He will enjoy listening to that. And that's the majority of people think that way. If I would be that guy, if I would be saying that, as many people say on the market, read the books about management for software engineering. Listen to the podcasts with people, which people record. Listen to the lectures on the management conferences. They keep talking that the soft skills is an important element of everything, and that people is the number one element of everything. And of course, we must not offend people by measuring their productivity, because this is how we destroy the team spirit. This is how we lose the motivation. We must let programmers creatively follow the great leader. And that's how the great product is being created. And then look at Elon Musk. So to answer your question, I'm not really my principles. In general, having principles is what makes your career growth very hard. Because with principles, you become a standalone element in any organization, because you have the principles, you have your own view, you have your own understanding, you have your own beliefs. And for an organization, that's a problem. The organization wants you to think like the organization thinks. The organization told you that this is good and this is bad. And what do you say? You don't argue. You don't interpret that. You just say, yes, this is good and this is bad. That's a perfect employee who deserves a career growth. That employee is effective for a company. It's very, very great element of the pyramid. And I'm not being sarcastic here. I'm not saying it with a negative tone. I'm saying this is how I would treat programmers if I would be the owner of a large hierarchical organization. I would be very suspicious with people who have their own opinion and who have principles, because we need to deal with them somehow. We need to convince them. We need to be careful with them. We need to design special rules probably for them. We need to take their opinion into account and their principles. That's hard. We're not here for that. We're here for making money using a large amount of slaves. And then one of those slaves is saying, I'm not a slave anymore. I have my opinion. I have my principles. You can imagine how far that guy can go in the hierarchy. Not so far. Next question. Which master's degree in Russia do you see as promising, or does the master's degree in IT not depend on the institute and location? Well, actually, in Russia there are a number of universities which are considered to be better than others. And definitely, you know them. You can Google up and you will find the top 10 or top 5. So definitely it's better to go there, I believe. Mostly because the teachers are better on average there. Because teachers, they do care where they teach. And if the teacher is good, then the teacher has a choice where to go. And it's impossible to be everywhere. So that's why you're going to meet better teachers. But if you ask me personally, I don't believe in teachers. I don't believe in that form of education, where you sit in the lecture, you listen to the teacher, and then you do the work, and then you the homework, and then you pass the exams. I think this kind of mechanism of obtaining knowledge is good for the average person. But I believe, since you're listening to my channel, you do not consider yourself as an average person. You want to be a bit better than that, a bit above that. And in that case, going through the standard flow of lectures and exams is not the best way to spend 5 years. Way better would be to go to the university in order to get the diploma, but don't try not to waste your time on those lectures and on those, on those exams and everything. Just do the minimum you need to do, just to not get rejected, or how do you say it? What's the right word in English? I don't know. Not to get out of that university. Do the minimum. But at the same time, with your free time, you study the topics which are most interesting for you, and there should be a limited number of them, and you study from the courses and from the books written by the best people in the industry. You're not going to meet Donald Knuth in Moscow State University, but you're going to waste time for a few years on listening to some guy who is far away from the world-class lecturer. You're going to waste time on listening to that, and you're going to miss the opportunity to watch the lectures of Donald Knuth or the lectures of, Martin Fowler, for example, if we're talking about software engineering. Or reading the books of the most professional and the most famous authors in the world. The teachers you have in the university, they are, in my opinion, at best, are supposed to be the direction setters. That's how I consider myself when I present my lectures to the students. I'm not supposed to be the knowledge provider, because who I am to provide the knowledge about, for example, code complexity checking. I have some lectures where I teach students about the complexity of the code. Who am I to teach that? I didn't invent that. I didn't do any publications about that. I didn't do any deep research about that. I barely know, I'm almost nobody in this particular area. So I'm not supposed to be the knowledge provider for my students. That would be a mistake for me. Instead, I'm just giving them the direction of study. I'm showing them where to go. This is my job. Because I remember when I was a kid, when I was a student, for me it was very confusing to understand what exactly I need to study. Because there are so many topics, there are so many books, there are so many domains, there are so many programming languages. I just don't know which one to touch. And I feel that I have a limited amount of time. I'm like 19 years old. And next year I'm going to be 20 years old. The life is almost finished. I need to immediately, right now, to find what is very important to study, to learn, to become a professional in. And I don't know which one to start with, because there are so many. The teacher, the job of the teacher, is to help that kid to find the right direction. Well, in order to find the right direction, the teacher has to show all the possible directions and do it in a very systematic way. The teacher has to say there are 12 different programming languages which have different programming paradigms, for example. Not 13, not 7, but 12. And this is what the teacher may do with enough certainty. And the kid will trust that information. The kid will say, okay, 12. That's all right. How many? 13. 12 languages. Let's put it this way. Okay, 12 different concepts of programming. And then the teacher says, this one was invented by that researcher. That one was implemented by that language. I don't recommend to touch that one because it's too old. I recommend this one, and that one because they are getting more popular. And you can read about all that in this, and that books. I prepared all these books for you. This is the full list of them. You can find them there, there, and there. I suggest you to go into this direction, that or that, and this is the amount of time it will take. This is more difficult, this is more easy, and so on and so forth. Then presenting such a systematic overview is the job of the teacher. And also the job of a teacher is to help the student to do first course works, the diploma works or course works, the first research work, where the student will dive deeper into certain problem and research it completely from the beginning till the end. And the teacher will just observe how it's happening, and again, not becoming the judge, not becoming the ultimate provider of the right knowledge of what is right, what is wrong. It shouldn't be that way. The teacher only looks at what's happening, what the student is doing, and suggesting where to present this work so that the judges, who are way more senior than this teacher, than me, will do the proper judgment of this work. So the job of the teacher is to connect the student with the world. And this is, I believe, not what most teachers are doing well. Well, at least in Russian universities. The first part is, the first mistake many teachers do is that they believe that their job is to present, is to teach, is to be the knowledge provider. And the second mistake, they don't connect the students with the world. They just connect the students with them. So you present your work and make me happy. Deliver me the result and I will be the judge. I will tell you whether you designed this software right or wrong, whether you wrote your paper right or wrong. And the students, of course, lose their opportunity to become international players, international software engineers, who are potentially visible on the global market. I hope I answered your question, but I said too much, I believe. Next question. What do you think, which place is better to start a career, in a big tech company or in a startup? Well, I answered that question earlier. I think the big tech company is way better than the startup. Try to watch one of my previous streams. You will see the more complete answer. Next question. Will you have a course in MIPT in the next year? I don't have such a plan for MIPT, but I'm ready to consider that if these people think that my contribution will be interesting, then I don't see the difference actually which university to teach in, because I teach, as you see on this YouTube channel, when I teach I record my videos and my lectures and then I publish them. So when people go to my lecture, I had, for example, yesterday I had a lecture and there were 12 people on online. 12 people were listening to my blah blah blah. But when I publish this lecture, then 1,000 people go there and watch. So who do you think I teach for? The students in the room or you, the viewers of my channel? So MIPT or HSE, what's the difference? Just another 12 people. Well, sometimes I have more, sometimes I have up to 50 people, but still it's 50. It's not 1,000. So you will ask me to present my lectures for MIPT. So what's the difference for the situation in general? There is no difference. It's going to be just another random 50 people. Next one. Do we need daily Scrum calls in modern work, or can we evaluate an employee's contribution based on commits and task statuses? You can try my blog and search for stand-up meetings. You will see how much I am against stand-up calls and this daily Scrum, as you call them. I think they were invented in order to help bad managers to somehow control the situation with the help of guilt, which people feel if you ask them to stand up in front of everybody and say that they didn't do much yesterday. In order to avoid such a humiliating procedure tomorrow, they will try to do at least something today. This is what Scrum stand-ups are about. If you are a better manager than that, then you will just introduce objective metrics of their productivity and then just reward them for achieving high numbers of these metrics. When they achieve, you give them some bonuses. When they don't achieve, you somehow punish them. For example, you don't give them the bonuses, or maybe you fire them. And of course, you're not going to need daily Scrum meetings. Next question, why I don't like Flutter? There are immutable objects, not so many static methods, and also UI looks like a composition of decorators. Well, it's not that I don't like Flutter. It's more like a joke because I never wrote. Well, I tried a little bit of this Flutter, but that was a long time ago. So I'm not a Flutter developer. So it's not like I don't like Flutter. But Flutter is the instrument for very high-level developers. Let's put it this way. Not system-level developers. Not the developers who develop something complex. But for people who just make software to make money. I'm not saying that these developers are bad developers. They need to exist because we do need these applications. We need a software to order pizza because I need pizza or whatever I order. Of course, we need these guys who will develop that. But I think that they just not the members of the community who are who is watching this channel right now. So if you come to my channel not for the courses about Flutter, I think if you're coming to this channel, then you are a bit more complex tasks in your life. Flutter is something that, and you don't need higher education for that. You don't need to be a PhD to write Flutter programs. You don't even need to be master. You just need to be someone with a computer and maybe a few months of study. I'm not saying that in that case you're less of a professional comparing to me, for example. It's just a different category of people, and these people are not, I cannot help these people. Let's put it this way. I cannot provide any information to these guys. I cannot give them anything interesting because they're doing something else. I addressed my messages to object-oriented programmers who develop something on a more system level. Let's put it this way. Next question. Am I in favor of formalism, which David West is discussing in his book, and in opposition to hermeneutic, I think. I'm not sure how to say it in English. It's quite a complicated question. I'm not sure I can answer it now. I am in general in favor of formalism. I'm in general in favor of rules, and especially in programming. So I would say yes, because I'm in general respect David West so much that I can say that anything the book says is true. That's my opinion about the book after reading it actually a few times. So I'm not afraid of being wrong here. Next question. What's your opinion on team set salaries? Team set salaries. If I would know what it means, that would be easier to answer. But let me guess. Team set salaries. So let's say the team decides what kind of salaries are supposed to be given to certain people. I'm in general strongly against the democratic way of management. I believe that a team can never make decisions which would be in favor of the team. The team will make decisions if we do it democratically, like ask people, what do you think? And they're going to suggest, and then we're going to vote, and then the decision will be made. Then the decisions which will be made in the end, they will be in favor of certain people in the team. And most probably in favor of the majority of the people in the team. So let's say we have, let's make an extreme example. Let's say we have a group of soldiers. And we ask them, what do you guys want? Do you want to run forward and attack the enemy? Or you want to go home and watch TV? Let's vote. Obviously, the decision will be made in favor of going back home and watching TV. And in the end, this decision will be very suitable for the majority of people in the team. But it's not going to be the best decision for the team in general, because the team will retreat and the team will lose, because the enemy will attack and all people are sitting at home and watching TV. So what's going to happen? All of these soldiers will probably be in trouble. The same for software teams. If we put the team together and go around and ask everybody, what do you want? What's most? They will say, I want bigger salary and I want less work. I want to use the technologies which I know. I want the management which is going to punish everybody except me. And this is what people are going to vote for. So asking these people to vote on salaries is just one example of this very ineffective democracy, I would say. It's ineffective. What's going to happen if you ask them to set salaries? Well, they will distribute the resources. And this is happening, actually, in the large companies. Sometimes there is such kind of freedom given to the programmers and the teams, and maybe key programmers. Let's say there is a team of 100 people, and the company says, this is the budget for you for a year, so let's take five leaders and five the most skillful people from the team and ask them how to distribute these resources, this entire budget distributed among all the people in the team for the next year. They will make the decision, but they will not consider the objective of the entire team. They will think about themselves, and this is reasonable. They will always think about their personal reasons, their personal goals, their personal greed, and whatever. They will look like people who make decisions for the company. They will try to pretend that they care about the company, they care about the group. But it's just unreasonable for them to care about, like it is unreasonable for the soldiers to care about running forward and dying for some for the motherland. Every soldier wants to go back home and watch TV. Every programmer cares about himself. So no, I say no on this team set salaries. Next question. You said that higher education gives greater benefit in salary and position than bachelor degree and work experience. But I can't agree with you. Okay. To my mind, this message continues. I suggest you to write shorter messages, because in this case I can glue them. I can read one message at a time. Okay, I'll try to continue. To my mind, nowadays companies try to measure your skills, but not amount of diplomas. Skills may be a work experience in a big company, open source product, but not a diploma. And you can stay 4 years. Okay, sorry, you wrote too much. But let me summarize. So I actually see some controversy of my message, which I delivered last time and a few times before. I do believe that your education matters and it's important. But at the same time, people keep asking me on the comments section in YouTube, why do I think so if companies indeed care about the source code which programmers can write, the problems which programmers can solve for practical software products? I suggest you to understand that when you ask me the question, what's good for you? I answer it to you personally. I don't answer to your boss. If your boss would come to me and say, what would be the best programmer for me? I would say, of course, it would be the programmer with no diploma and very good hard skills, very shy, very having the lack of soft skills, ready to write code 12 hours a day and asking for as little money as possible. That's the perfect programmer for you. Try to find that guy. That would be my advice for your boss. Of course, find somebody without the diploma, because why do you need somebody who can quit? Why do you need somebody who is too smart to look around? You need somebody who can write Java code. Find that guy. But you're coming to me with a different request. You're coming to me and asking how to be more effective, how to make more money, how to build the career. And I'm telling you, forget about the needs about your boss. Let him care about that. You care about yourself. And I guarantee you that if you have more diplomas, if you have more education, if you get the PhD, then your career, your money, your income will be easier generated. Of course, the company will not be, for the company, you will not look like the traditional programmer, like a regular programmer. You will stand out a little bit if you have a PhD. And if you have papers published in top-class conferences, you will look even more standout. You will look even more different than everybody else. It's going to be some kind of inconvenience for the company, but there will be companies in this world, for example, Google, who will appreciate that kind of expertise, that kind of profile. And believe me, they will eventually find you. And yes, your regular employer who you work for right now doesn't care about your diplomas because you don't have too many of them right now. If you ask questions, if you're watching me, so probably you're curious. So that's why it means that you're somewhere in the middle of your career growth. So you don't have yet many diplomas or many public works published or many, I don't know, books published. You don't have it yet. You're only planning to get there. If you would be already there, you would not ask that question. You would already know what's happening at that point. So remember, there are two points of view. The point of view of a boss and the point of view of you, the employee. And they're opposite. Next question. You value Stack Overflow reputation. However, I guess you do recognize that most reputation is given to obvious things, like how to list files in a bash, which is not a sign of high value. I do recognize that. I can tell you an interesting story. When I was starting Stack Overflow, using Stack Overflow, that was more than 10 years ago. I had zero reputation at that time. And I remember at that time, the Stack Overflow was quite small. And when I was asking questions about Java, almost the same people were answering me. So we just knew each other. There was like maybe a few hundred people or something. That was the early days of Stack Overflow. And I remember one guy who was answering my questions about Maven, about Java. I was very junior at that time. I didn't know many things. So he was helping me and he was growing his reputation. And I remember when he got 100,000 reputation, I had maybe, I don't know, 3,000 at that time. He was way above me. 100,000 at that time, 10 years ago, he was just top 100 users on Stack Overflow. And I remember how I said in one of the comments there, I said, congratulations for getting 100K. And he said, yeah, I'm looking for another 100. And then he disappeared. Like, he's not posting answers anymore. He lost his interest, or I don't know where he is, but he's gone from Stack Overflow. I know his profile, he's there. So he's gone when he was like 120 or something. That was really literally 10 years ago. Now he has 500,000. So from 100,000 to 500,000, he grew doing nothing. He just literally didn't do anything because he disappeared. He's not touching his account for 10 years. So that tells us, this story tells us that you grow the reputation, not from the obvious things, but the things which are valuable for people for a long time. If people like your answers, if they like your questions, then they're going to upvote, and you're going to grow and grow. This is what happens to my reputation as well. I was very active user earlier. Now I'm not so active user. I post questions there maybe a few times a month, and I rarely post answers. But my reputation keeps growing. I'm getting about plus 100 every week. So every week I go to Stack Overflow, there's plus 100. I'm just getting these numbers for the questions I asked earlier. And I do agree with you that some of my questions and some of my answers are quite trivial, but they are well respected and by the community and upvoted a lot. But they are trivial, that's true. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't contribute to the community now. You just try. Just try spending 1 hour on Stack Overflow every day for 3 months, and you will see how your life will change. You will see how interesting it is. You will see how your soft skills will grow. You will see how you will enjoy being there. Well, in the beginning, you're not going to enjoy it, but after 3 months, you will enjoy it a lot. And you will start respecting yourself for the profile you have there, for the answers people upvote, for the help you deliver to those people. Just do it. 1 hour every day. Just go to, let's say, Java questions and just stay watching those questions and go to every question which is asked there. Read the question, post a comment or post an answer. Just try to help people. 1 hour every day for 3 months, and then come back to this podcast and tell us about your experience. Next question. Is it possible to move to object-oriented programming, which I am talking about, from a regular Spring object project? What would I do if I would want to make such a migration in a project? I would never want to make such a migration in a project. If we're talking about the product which is in production, then walking away from Spring, no, it's a suicide mission. It's not going to work. Maybe I would try to start convincing my fellow programmers that certain aspects of object-oriented programming may be applicable to your project. For example, let's agree that static methods are not the best way to write object-oriented code. Or let's agree that getters and setters is not something that we should respect, and we should try to get rid of getters, setters, and DTO and everything. But step by step, and maybe some of those practices will be accepted. But Spring is a dominating platform, and it's impossible. I think we're doomed to be there. We're doomed. It's like Ruby on Rails. Ruby on Rails is the same story. We have Ruby and we have a framework called Ruby on Rails. Ruby is a great language. Ruby on Rails, it's a different story. It's like Spring for Java. So people who write in Ruby on Rails, they're not object-oriented programmers. They're something else. Again, I'm not saying they're bad people, but they're not object-oriented programmers. They, just like Spring developers, they are not really Java developers. They are Spring developers. They don't understand object orientation. And it's very often happens when the resume, the CV comes to me and I'm constantly looking for employees. So if you want to join, text me and I will be glad to interview you and give you a feedback. But every time I see the Spring framework in the CV standing on the first position, I know how the interview will go. I know that it's not going to be anything interesting, that I will just ask the questions and the answers will be that I don't really understand Java. That's what people say sometimes. I don't really understand concurrency in Java, for example. I just don't. I never use it. I just do Spring. We never start threads. We never start thread pools. We never synchronize anything. It's just done under the hood in Spring. We just don't care about that. But how can we actually call these people Java programmers? Next question. Should every team lead, a manager, know all the topics from your PMBA course? Also, should every manager pass PMP certification? Actually, thanks for mentioning this course, this PMBA. It was interesting for me, this course, very unusual. And I do recommend every team lead and every manager to at least watch the course I presented there. It was in Innopolis University. I tried in this course to summarize my thoughts about management, and definitely would be great. About the PMP certification, I definitely recommend every project manager to try to pass the certification. It is difficult. It is hard. The preparation. I remember how much time I spent on that and how many interesting things I learned while preparing for the certification. PMP is definitely an achievement. It's like PhD. It's going to be something on your profile. Next question. What would you do if you catch one of the engineers in your team in a situation the engineer has additional parallel work? That's an interesting question. I would feel extremely bad about myself. I would understand that I'm a lousy manager, that I am not able to control my people. I'm not able to understand what they do, that my management system is so weak that it's possible to be here and at the same time work somewhere else and remain invisible, remain unnoticed. That's extremely strong signal for me as a manager. So I would definitely not punish that guy. I would actually try to think about my own professional skills as a manager. The guy is fine. He's doing the best for himself. Actually, he's a great guy. I would actually try to learn from that guy how he can do that. But I would not be angry about that. I would be super angry to myself. Next question. If I have an invitation to lead a course at MIPT, I would be glad to attend it instead of another course. Okay, probably we'll meet there. Please suggest popular open source projects supported by the Russian community. Well, we have many projects. Well, actually, what's interesting, you know, we have a competition, which I mentioned before. We have a competition for open source projects, which we're planning to run in a few months, which is called KaiCode. K-A-I. I will have the link under the video. And in this competition, we invite, including Russian, not only Russian, but all projects. We invite these open source, young open source projects. But what's interesting is that in Russia, there are a few other competitions like that, specifically targeted to Russian projects. For example, Yandex. Yandex is a Russian company. They organize a competition for open source projects where the majority of projects constitute Russian projects. Try to go there, Google for Yandex open source competition or whatever, you will find it easily, and there you will see a list of projects which were submitted. Take any of them and start contributing. Next question, one more question and we finish. Any recommendation for foreign people wanting to get into the IT world in Russia? Oh, that's a great question. Thanks for that. I think there will be more and more people with this plan. Because I think Russia is growing in terms of economical growth, in terms of IT, in terms of political growth, everything. Everything is getting better. That's my personal subjective understanding of what's happening here. So I definitely recommend, if you live outside, if you are from a different country, you will be, I think, will be welcome here. If you speak English, you will be like a star. in a Russian company. Many Russian companies would love to have you because of your foreign passport, because of your English, because you will bring the international spirit to the team. Just go to the market. In Russia, we have a number of websites where you can publish your CV and start talking to the companies. And you can get the permission, the work permission to work in Russia. It takes, I think, a few weeks, maybe 2 weeks to get a work permit in Russia. You just go here. You just fly to Russia. You just rent a place to live. Then you go to, you can go to some lawyer and pay some money, or you can go directly to apply for this, it's called in Russia, it's called work patent. So you just get a permission to work and you pay for this patent every month. There's a certain amount of money, I think it's $30. So you pay every month $30 and you continue paying for this patent. And having this patent allows you to work for any company in Russia legally. That's it. It's that easy. It's not like in the United States. It's not like in any other country. It's just 2 weeks and you get a work permit and you can work. So do it. Try it out. I believe you will enjoy it. Thanks for coming, guys. That's it for today. Next time it's going to be in Russian. Today it was in English. I hope my English was good enough to understand me. Thanks. Bye-bye.